Science has fascinated Anissa Ramirez ever since she watched her very first episode of the PBS Kids science show 321 Contact. It changed the way she looked at the world and put her on a career path. Today, Ramirez is a materials scientist. She's done research at Bell Labs and has taught at Yale and MIT. She's also on a quest to transform our understanding of inventions, how they came to be, and how they've shaped us. In her new book, The Alchemy of Us, she writes, "In order to create the finest version of ourselves, we need to think critically about the tools that surround us." Anissa Ramirez joins me on the phone. Hello. Good morning. How are you?
Hello. I'm fine, thank you. Thank you so much.
I understand you were inspired to write this book after a particularly challenging glass-blowing class. What happened during that class?
Well, there's a wonderful studio not far from me. I live in New Haven in Brantford, and I wanted to take some glass-blowing classes just on my bucket list. So it was fun, but I was also very scared. And usually I would take out a small amount of glass and then make a small vase. But one day I came in a very bad mood and actually took a lot of glass on the end of my pipe. As I was making this piece, all I had to do was one last step, but I wasn't really paying attention because I was talking to a friend, and the glass piece fell on the floor. My instructor came by, and he fixed it. He reattached it to my pipe, and we were able to put it back together, although it had now had a flattened side. But as it was cooling and as I was just kind of calming down, I thought a little bit about what had happened. I was shaping the glass, but the glass was actually shaping me. I came to the class in a bad mood, and I was leaving in a better mood. And it might feel a little existential, but I just said, I wonder how materials and humans have been shaping each other over the eons. And so that's what compelled me to write my book, The Alchemy of Us.
It's clear in reading your book that this is not a dry scientific tome. You tell some very compelling stories about fascinating characters who played very significant roles in innovations that changed and are still changing our culture for better and for worse. The eight chapters highlight specific innovations. The chapter called Convey explores the development of the telegraph. C, that's S-E-E, is all about the invention of artificial light. And in Capture, you focus on photography. With so many inventions over the millennia, how did you narrow down the choices to just eight?
Well, yeah, I could have written, it could have been much, much longer. But when I was in the architecture of the book, I was looking for stories, and they had to show how humans changed. And as you mentioned, the chapters are given titles that are verbs. And so when I was hunting for various stories, I found eight very compelling stories to do that. There are other materials that I definitely could have focused on, but these seemed to sing the loudest. So that's how I selected it. Each material really had to show how it impacted culture by changing the human experience.
I'd like to talk a little bit about your first chapter called Interact, where you take on time itself through clocks and how they now control our sleep. How did that happen?
Well, Interact is one of my favorite chapters because it starts off with a woman who sold time.
Yes, I've never heard that story before, and I found it fascinating.
So, you know, in the 19th century, as we were becoming more and more obsessed with time, someone actually had a job where they would walk around with their watch that was certified from the Royal Observatory and show it to different businesses. Now, before Ruth Belville had her business, people slept differently. We used to sleep in two different segments. We would go to bed at 9 o'clock, go to sleep for about 3.5 hours, wake up for about an hour, do something around the house, read, talk to our neighbors who are also up, and then go back to sleep for another 3.5 hours. These segments were called first and second sleep, and everyone slept that way. And if you read old books, you'll see words like first sleep and second sleep. This is what they mean. As we became more obsessed with time, we had to wake up earlier, so one of those segments got truncated, and also with the development of electrical lights, the first segment got truncated, and then they consolidated, and that type of sleep is how we sleep today.
And that, you point out, has an impact on health.
Oh, absolutely. A lot of people will say that they have some form of insomnia, and historians actually think that it's harkening back to this old way of sleeping. And it also, in terms of our health, the artificial light seems to also be impacting our health because our bodies actually have two modes. We have a daytime mode and we have a nighttime mode. How the body knows what mode to be in is based on blue light. Now, when our ancestors were alive, they lived by sunlight, which has a lot of blue in it, and then candlelight, which has less. But we live under artificial lights all the time. And when we're in daytime mode, our bodies are in growth mode, and that's actually impacting us because our cells will respond to that growth mode in some ways that we don't necessarily want.
You bring up the chapter about the electric light or artificial light. And, of course, you include Thomas Edison in the chapter, which is called C. But it seems that your protagonist, I guess I could call him, is really an inventor named William Wallace of Ansonia, Connecticut. Why is he a player in this story?
Well, I really loved William Wallace because if you read books about Edison, very thick books, you'll always see William Wallace as a footnote. And I said, who is this guy? I found out that Edison actually came to Ansonia, and he met William Wallace. Wallace had created an early form of electric light. It was an arc light, so it was very, very bright. It was sort of like a searchlight, so it wasn't really useful for the home. But Edison saw this and said, hey, I think I'm going to start working on electric lights. And then he went back to Menlo Park in New Jersey and created his incandescent bulb. But he wouldn't have had that idea if he didn't come to Connecticut. And most people in Connecticut don't know this, that Edison came up here. So that's the reason why I highlighted William Wallace, because I wanted this little-known inventor to get his moment in the sun.
And no pun intended, although moment in the sun, you just had one yourself. No pun intended, there was sort of a dark side to this for William Wallace. You mentioned that the day that Thomas Edison came to visit Wallace in Ansonia was really the beginning of a period of darkness for Wallace because he was cut out of the invention process beyond that time.
That's absolutely right. I mean, Wallace thought his moment had come. You know, the great wizard of Menlo Park came to visit him to see what he had created. And Wallace had created not only this fantastic light, he created a special generator which transmitted the water power from the Naugatuck River into electricity because, well, there wasn't any electricity in the homes yet. And so Edison said, well, I want one of these electrical systems. He brought it back to his place in Menlo Park, and he cut Wallace out of the deal. He just bought the units from Wallace and never included Wallace in his inventions going forward.
You also talk about the things that we've lost along with what we gained through these innovations, all of the ones that you you talk about in the book. For example, with the light bulb, we lost darkness. So tell us about that downside.
Well, our ancestors used to look and see thousands of stars. Now, if you and I look up, we'll see maybe about 50. I think recently I went on a trip and I went to a place that was very, very dark. And this dark sky is amazing. You really feel very small and you feel connected to nature. So I do talk about how that has happened as a result of having all these lights, this abundance of lights. It really disconnects us from really seeing how beautiful the night sky is.
And one of the illustrations that you use when talking about the effect on the environment is the life cycle of the lightning bug or the firefly.
Yeah, well, you know, on the East Coast, we're very lucky. We have this wonderful bug called the lightning bug or firefly, but it ends up that on the West Coast, the fireflies don't make it that far. And the number of fireflies has been decreasing, and the reason is because of the lights. Fireflies speak to each other through a Morse code of flashes, but it's really important that they see each other. And in a dark sky, they can see each other, connect, and make, well, future fireflies. But when there's a streetlight overhead, the female firefly doesn't know to flash back to the male firefly, so they don't meet. So that's why their number is decreasing. So, you know, even though artificial lights are convenient for us, for humans, they're really making life difficult for fireflies.
Since you mentioned the Morse code that the fireflies use, I'd like to jump over to Convey, the third chapter in the book about telegraph wires and the invention of the telegraph with Samuel B. Morse. And you connect Morse with a number of things in culture that have changed over the years, including the way we write and also a lack of personal social interaction due to things like texting and emails and whatnot. Could you connect those dots for us?
Sure. Well, when Morse was first making his telegraph, he would work with his assistant, And he would chide him and say, "Condense your language," you know, which was harsh language back in those days. And what he was trying to tell Vail is to not write so much when you're sending a message, because what Vail would do, or what Morse would do, is they would write their letters by longhand and then convert all the letters of the alphabet in the Word into dots and dashes and type in those dots and dashes and then figure out what those dots and dashes mean and then write out the word. That took a lot of time. And so Morse would get a message from Vail, and it would be dash, four dots, and then another dot, and he would convert it, and he'd see it's the word "the." He's like, that's a lot of work for a word that doesn't do very much. So he was telling Vail to shorten what you're saying in what you're in the message that you're transmitting. That ends up that telegraphs became very popular in society, and telegraph officers would tell customers to be brief, because the telegraph was great in sending information long distances, but it couldn't handle a lot of messages. And so the officers wanted customers to just send very short messages so that they can keep it available for the next set of customers. Telegraphs became popular in newsrooms, and editors would tell their reporters to be succinct. Again, one of the limitations of their prose was because of the telegraph. Now, there was one reporter that really loved this style of writing with short declarative sentences. His name was Ernest Hemingway. So the way that he writes is a style that was designed by the use of the telegraph. So this is how one technology, this technology of the telegraph, has changed how we use language. Now, the other thing that you mentioned is about how the telegraph has squeezed out the human part. Morse used to write very, very long letters and use wonderful prose that described everything that was around him. But when you use the telegraph, you don't have that luxury. And so the progeny of the telegraph is text messages. And again, when we as humans communicate, we use a lot of different ways of getting a message across besides words. Well, you can look at body language, we can look at people's eyes. And as a result of communicating through this one-dimensional way, what historians and linguists and scholars are concerned with is that we're reducing our ability to empathize. So that's one of the things that I also point to in The Alchemy of Us, that this technology is useful in getting information across, but it's deteriorating our ability to be human with each other, that is to empathize and to relate with one another.
Your chapter about photography, called Capture, explores several stories and several dimensions of how photography affected culture in the years following its invention and development. One I'd like to talk about, you explain how the development of film actually contributed to the stereotyping of African Americans. Can you please connect those dots for us?
Well, it ends up that the most photographed person in the world at one point was Frederick Douglass. Not Lincoln, not Twain, Frederick Douglass. Now, why was he so crazy about getting selfies of himself? Well, he was trying to use his image as a way to combat the negative stereotypes about African Americans. There were a lot of caricatures that were hand-drawn, and they would show people with exaggerated expressions, with eyes that were white and bugging out, and wide smiles. And if you've ever seen a picture of Frederick Douglass, he looks so regal. He's a handsome-looking guy. He wanted to combat that image. And so that's the reason why every time he went by a portraiture place to take for pictures, he would go in to take his picture, because those pictures would also be sold. And so he wanted to use this as a way to combat that stereotype. So I talk about how Frederick Douglass used photography as a way to combat that.
Maybe you could talk about a bit more about the technical issue that resulted in film, really all the way into the latter part of the 20th century, resulting in film that just did not expose correctly darker skin.
Okay, that's a very good question. In the 1950s, 1960s, African-American mothers were looking at the class photo of their children, and they saw something that didn't look right. The black children did not come out as well as the white children. And African-American mothers, they asked manufacturers of film to say, you know, we need to fix this. What they had seen is that actually there was a bias in the film. The film was tailor-made, or it was optimized for people with lighter skin, because the main customer were people who were of lighter complexion. And so initially camera film was egalitarian. because it was homemade chemistry that you can do in your kitchen. And so whoever took a picture, their likeness would be depicted. But as it became manufactured by companies, they tailored the process so that it was optimized for a certain population. And this is what these African-American mothers saw in the 1950s. And so after some chiding, not from these African-American mothers, even though they wrote letters, it was only when two businesses, furniture manufacturers and confectioners that make chocolate, when they told this manufacturer that they needed to change their film, that changes happened because they wanted their chocolates of different flavors of, you know, white chocolate, milk chocolate, dark chocolate. They wanted people to be able to discern those different types of chocolate. And in the current form of the film, that wasn't happening. So eventually the formulation was changed so that film was more democratic and could pick up different hues of chocolate as well as different hues of skin.
And I can't let you go without asking for your perspective on the COVID-19 pandemic. I'm wondering, is there an innovation from our past that you think helped create this unfortunate situation?
I don't know if there's an innovation in our past. I mean, we've benefited from not having pandemics because we've got tremendous medicines. And we've got new technologies that can do things that couldn't happen as quickly in the past. We can trace. We can test. So we've got things to combat it a little bit better. We're not actually using them as well as we could, but technologies can certainly help.
And from your vantage point as a scientist and a science communicator, how do you see this pandemic transforming perhaps science and our culture looking forward?
This pandemic, I think, is also because people feel disconnected from science. If people were a little bit more informed about how things work, they would adhere, they would comply a little bit more. But I think because we've had a little bit of a breakdown in how we teach science, STEM particularly, we don't see how we are part of a global system, that what you do affects me. You know, as scientists, we forgot to teach that. And so as a result, people don't see that their actions actually have some ripple effects outward. So that's kind of what I see as the impact. And I hope that going forward, scientists, science communicators, and also society in general will just realize that there's an ecology, that what you do affects other people, although you may not be able to see them.
My ignorance is showing here now. You're a materials scientist. Could you explain just what that is?
I tell people that I'm an atom whisperer. And what I'm interested in is it's material science sits where chemistry and physics overlap. So chemistry is interested in how things bond, and physicists are interested in how materials behave in different situations. And so I want to show how one thing is linked to the other. So that's what a material science is. And it's not very well known, but a lot of the things that you take for granted, such as the cell phone and this phone call being made by microphones, that's all material science.
Anisa Ramirez is a materials scientist who lives in New Haven and the author of The Alchemy of Us. Ms. Ramirez, thanks so much for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you.